bringing in Christ.
Talks nice.
Doesn't he?
And sitting next to Kurt, we have Carl Steve McNeil. Creator of the independent science fiction book Finder, his richly detailed and complex series justly celebrated as one of the more extraordinary pieces of world building that one could hope to find in contemporary comics. The Finder is also a beautifully drawn book, particularly notable for the creativity of McNeil's layouts, which I think sometimes have an Eisner-esque quality all of their own. And perhaps we'll talk a bit more about that. And last but by no means least, sitting next to Carla, great Tim Sale. And I think those are perhaps best known for his runs of highly regarded collaborations with writer Jeff Loeb, including for DC, Batman the Long Halloween, Batman Dark Victory, and Superman for All Seasons. So for Marvel, the so-called color series, Daredevil Yellow, Spider-Man Blue, Hulk Gray. He also collaborated with Donald Cobb on one of my favorite Superman stories of the past decade, Superman and Kryptonite, a text that received a very warm reception from my students when I taught it a couple of years ago.
Wow, better yet.
So, please welcome our distinguished panelists. So I thought I'd begin by inviting you all just to sort of wax lyrical about Eisner's basic sense of design. Before we even get into specific stories, I have a selection of classic title pages. This one is actually, I think, unusual in that the Spirit logo is actually just floating there on the surface.
Not incorporated into anything, yes.
And I thought I'd begin with this because this is something that you hardly ever see.
But also, I mean, the way he uses it, you've got a plane defined by the logo and that caption that makes the fact that we're looking down at that scene below all the steeper by defining, you know, the front.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but I think that's absolutely right.
Because as a splash page, you know, if you eliminated everything but the title and the tiny figure of the spirit and his shadow, it would still be just as striking. But of course, you know, Eisner had old school chops on perspective that he certainly never shied away from showing.
Well, here's a more typical example which has that feature, but as you can see, and the image is reading okay for everyone? Clear? Yes. Great. As you can see, this, so this is the, you know, the logo famously in the long pieces of paper. This, I think, Tim, is one of, you actually listed this as one
of the things. One of my questions was, when I went back and looked at, like, just the book collections that I had, a lot of times it'll have Eisner as a writer and then completely somebody else as the artist. And so I wondered what sort of input, since the splashes especially are so striking. Mm-hmm. Maybe Kurt knows or something, I don't know. How much did Eisner
actually do
if somebody else is credited as the artist?
I think that...
Or are those just pendants?
Or maybe he just did splashes and then...
A lot of times, I mean, I don't specifically know, but a lot of times back then, when they used a different letterer, they'd have the you know, traditional, the letterer who did all the cool lettering, do the splash page, and then they'd switch to somebody else thereafter. And certainly...
Not draw the splash page.
No, letter the splash
page.
Yeah,
right, okay.
And sort of establish a look. And certainly in the Simon and Kirby studio, for instance, Kirby did a lot of splash pages that were then, the story then moved on to another artist.
Right.
So I wouldn't be at all surprised if Eisner, you know, either was roughing out a story
right.
for these other artists or at least doing, you know, a splash page. There's a Kirby story, this doesn't have anything to do with Eisner, but there's a Kirby story that I found fascinating, a Kirby Ditko story, where
God, you, I love them together.
Yes,
what a combination! Yeah.
It was the first of the, I guess now we call them the Dr. Druid stories, but they were Dr. Doom when they first appeared, and it was very clear that Kirby did full pencils on like pages 1 and 2. And then on page 8, there was a transformation, and so he full penciled that, and the other pages were looser and were more Ditko.
Uh-huh.
And so Kirby was doing tight pencils whenever any new piece of design happened.
Right.
And in between that, he was like, "Ah, Steve can draw that."
Really, is that what he would say?
Perhaps not in that accent.
I think for people who aren't aware of it, you guys are probably all hardcore Eisner fans, or you wouldn't be here at all, but it is one of the more interesting debates about this is a guy that ran a studio, an established artist of this period, especially working in the newspaper system. It meant you'd arrived if you had 5 or 6 people to actually do a lot of the other work for you. But I think the splash pages are one of the places where he maintained a lot of control. Jules Pfeiffer, I was reading an interview with him, where Pfeiffer said that Eisner would, some days he'd pay close, when Pfeiffer wrote a story for him, he would some days pay close attention. There were other days when he would completely ignore it. Sometimes Pfeiffer would thumbnail things and Eisner would actually loosely follow them. There were other days when he would completely, change everything around. And Pfeiffer could never predict what Bill was going to go with or not. So it became very difficult years later to say what was his idea.
Well, the splashes are so distinctive.
Mm. Right.
And so design heavy. And then the stories are often just, they're tiny panels and everybody's very cartoony.
Right. It's the sort of thing
like
that
so you
could
just
hand
have
it off to an
Jerry Grandinetti could do it.
But on the other hand, Jerry Grandinetti is a wonderful designer.
The creepy and eerie stuff, especially for me.
Eisner, no matter how many assistants he used, Eisner was the packager.
Yeah.
Eisner was in charge of the look and was directing these guys. And I would suspect, although I don't know, that Pfeiffer was saying, he wasn't paying attention sometimes, and that meant he didn't have any problem with it.
He had a hell of an eye for collaborators from that point of view. I mean, Bob Powell, Jerry Grandinetti, Wally Wood. It's an amazing list of people that were doing this kind of work. And of course, Jules Pfeiffer goes on to become people outside of.
Yeah.
Places like Comic-Con is actually the more famous creative for some people.
And there's nothing like the kind of creative competition you can get rolling with a good group of people whose skills mesh reasonably well anyway. If someone's always trying to top the last splash page or what have you, you're always going to find some new and interesting way of doing something.
I wanted to point out that one of the interesting things about these two splash pages, so here it is in black and white, which is actually the way that I most like to look at Eisner. I think those kitchen sink reprints from the 70s are still the place where I most like to read him. But this is his color version of that same splash page, and as you can see, there's hardly any color. And that in itself, for a medium where, one thinks of sort of color, the primary colors of comic books being so central, a decision to actually just have your sort of halo spotlights there as the main source of color, that in itself is an exciting design choice.
Well, you certainly see the streetcar a lot better. But I don't like it at all.
It's better in black and white. But also, this wasn't merely the splash page. This was the cover.
Right.
Because this was like the spirit section was a magazine in the Sunday paper.
Oh, a magazine.
So it was like the comic section, but this was the first page of the whole section, so it served as a cover as well.
Yeah, Eisner famously said that he felt that this was the place. It's going to take you 10 minutes to read it. He wanted to orient you towards what kind of, because one of the wonderful things about the spirit is that it's a mixed bag generically. It's funny some weeks, it's tragic other weeks, it's crime noir some weeks, it's a musical occasionally. I kid you not, there are whole sort of sung, strips. The splash page was how he could orient the reader to sort of get the right genre goggles on before you get into what's next. So this is clearly some sort of crime noir setup, but there'll be other.
Yeah. I just love the and even though this is a great splash design, the whole concept of what the story is follows through on.
Yeah, I gave another page to someone so people could see. This is the design of that first page is.
You think Frank Miller was influenced by these, just a little?
Just a little.
I almost dropped, actually, an early Daredevil in here for comparison purposes, but I decided not to. It's Will's show.
Yeah, why fuck it up?
Sorry, Tim, I spoke across you.
No. It just that the, I think it's the top three floors are always shown, and so that the top tier of three panels is one floor. The next one is the next floor down, and the next one is the next floor down. And I think the whole story runs through that way.
Yeah, that's right.
So.
And you have this brickwork between the gutters.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that the audience is cued to that.
Yeah, for dumb distinction.
Speaking of Eisner's influence again, Alan Moore did one of these in Tomorrow Stories.
Uh-huh.
Where it was exactly the same setup, story happening on three different levels of a building.
Was there a tall panel on the side?
There was not.
Okay.
It set it up on the splash page, and then it was just nine panels.
I love it with the tall panel on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just in terms of, if you think about, you know, opening up a comic book and paging through, you know, this is not a designing choice that you're going to see.
Was anybody else doing anything like it?
I can't imagine who. Not at the time.
At the time, is that what I mean? Yeah.
Nobody comes to mind.
Yeah.
Hal has some real ambition in some of those early horror stories, but not at this level.
Right.
So here's another famous legendary title page. Actually, for me, this is the way I like Eisner the best. He's so successful at the splash pages that often when I think, oh man, I want to read the story that has this, you know, that's what he wanted you to do, of course, is read that story. And then quite often when I actually read the story, I'm less excited than I am by the title page. I just want to.
The formal experimentation is wonderful, but, you know, there's only so much of it you can do and still keep the story moving forward, though. You know, there are many, many artists who sacrifice emotional or intellectual impact of any given sequence just because they want to have their panel design balanced on either side. They run out of, you know, where they need to have a close-up of a character's expression. They don't put it in simply because, you know, it would mess with their design.
And,
well, that's why the writer needs to be a big part of it as well. You've got to be collaborating on that.
Yeah, and somebody like Eisner, who was a terrific designer, could, you know, treat the script as a suggestion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you know, if he saw a way to accomplish it visually, the script could bend to the graphics. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that title at the bottom, Fox at Bay, that was done later. That was done for a reprint. The original newspaper printing they didn't have story titles.
I don't know, but I actually just reread this story. Are people familiar with this story? Are people who know this one? This is a really unusual. This is one of the stories that actually does stand up, and it took me by surprise because it's not quite suggested by this image. It's about a guy who basically, you know, goes postal before we had that expression.
Mm-hmm.
The central character, whose name is Reynard, hence the fox,
right.
Goes into his office building and murders 12 people. And then starts writing a diary, waiting for the police to come and get him. And the whole thing in his mind is a psychological experiment. It's basically somebody doing suicide by cop after having massacred a building full of people.
One would think you could just
punch
one.
1949?
It's
Ferguson.
You don't have to actually kill
12
people.
It's actually a story about mass murder in an office building.
Probably get you beaten.
Before that kind of crime, was a, you know, normal part of the fabric of
America.
Maybe
you'd have to go on a little bit.
So that hence the bodies scattered through. From a distance, that might be easier to read than close up.
Yeah.
The stretchy.
Stretchy. stretchy.
The stretchy spirit.
Stretchy.
Yeah, and there's a big metaphor. You know, the whole splash page there is a turning the logo into a visual metaphor for what the story is going to be about, and having Dolan explain it to you.
Right.
So usher you into the story. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Tangent.
Well, it's like a Saul Bass poster, you know. I mean, he revolutionized the movie poster to take a, you know, one hopes a single poetic evocative, you know.
Yeah, but it's image. At least 10 years before Saul Bass did.
Way before. Took it a long time to make it to the movies.
I think the next one is actually another one that Tim mentioned. Yeah. Favorite.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Escape. So, I don't know if you can see, this is either the bars of the prison that have been turned into the logo here.
And this is Ben Oda lettering, I'm pretty sure.
Again, didn't he, and he didn't do all? I thought he did.
Stories.
He came in partway through the run.
Oh, okay.
He was
one of them gets sent back to jail, two of them die, I think.
I just think about
it. Don't break out of prison.
Do you have the next page?
I don't think I do.
Yeah, because the breakout is just a terrific storytelling design sort of thing. And that's most of what I remember about the story.
I may have a picture, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
I've got some more goofy ones, like this, because of course this is a newspaper strip, insert in a newspaper.
Yeah.
So here's, you know, for Thanksgiving you have your seasonal.
I love the Christmas ones, my favorite.
Mm-hmm. I've never done a Christmas cover, you know, or anything of the kind. I really keep telling myself that I should.
Mm-hmm.
Just even though it has nothing to do with what's going on inside, so what?
Well, and he did, obviously, with only 7-8 pages to work in, to use the front page also as a story page if he felt he had a story that required it narratively,
uh-huh.
In which case the title would become hidden away in the background. So here it's the awning of the...
And I think both of those story titles at the top are later additions.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Hmm.
It would have originally had the newspaper header with action, suspense, mystery.
So 10 minutes
all in the middle of
that, but we'll come
yeah,
back that.
10 minutes is possibly the all-time best spirit story. One of the all-time best stories.
I don't know it.
What?
I don't know it.
You don't know it?
I don't know it?
I didn't know it.
Just because of the just using the little girl playing ball, you know, doing the A, my name is Anna thing as a timing. You know, anybody who's ever played that game as a kid, you know, or any bouncing ball game, just keeps everything in perspective. How much time has passed? You know how much time has passed just because you got to know what letter the kid's on by the time you get back out to the street.
Yeah, this actually, can you guys see again the lettering disappearing in the gutter here? So I love that. I did get the second page of this one in because I love the second page of this one. Again, the design choice, the way that your eye follows the title of the strip down into the gutter. It turns out that this is a sewer above and underground. Jail outside of prison, and there's a jail cell under the ground.
Of
so
course.
On the next page, and again, I get you both here
wow.
So you can see how that sequence works. So when you go from that title page, splash page, with your eye already being led down into the drain, and then the first panel on the next page is what is the view from under the grate.
Yeah.
And then the three guys in the jail cell are Eisner, Grandinetti, and... whoever his other assistant was at that time. But they're all... So the three prisoners are caricatures of the creative team behind the strip.
Fun.
I gave you color on this one as well, so again, you could see that the contrast.
Hey.
Yeah.
No.
No.
Yeah, it's definitely...
No.
It's easy to pick out the lettering, but it's better in my mind.
But Zipitones. That's great.
It's another example of
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he would abandon imagery altogether for pure lettering. That's a nice one.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting the sense here of, you know, you were being taken to school as to how to do a strip every week and surprise the reader every time?
Yeah, that's
one. I spent a lot of time wandering around with a notebook after reading that one, just transcribing all the sounds and people speaking all around me. That was an education. That one was.
I feel like I'm in a school center. It's a playground. So, this is one of them. Opening with Dolan, the police detective, the Commissioner Gordon equivalent figure, I guess, is what we could call him. And the spirit is clearly in a bad way. The spirit, for those of you who don't know the strip, he's a character. We probably should talk a bit about the character himself in that case.
Well, he's kind of that much to him.
I think that one of the reasons the spirit has been so hard to do for without Eisner is because the character is such a cipher, actually. There's not, he's an excuse for Eisner to tell whatever story he wants to tell. And
he's a himbo.
As a hero, yeah, he's a detective, but he's never struck me as particularly smart. I mean, he isn't that bright, right? He often doesn't solve the crime or solves the crime by accident or.
Right, when he's persistent.
Yeah.
And he keeps looking until he finds something, but he doesn't make great deductive
links. No, there's no Batman-like moments of, you know, sort of connection.
There are one or two if it's that kind of story, but not usually.
And
I don't know about, you know, my esteemed fellow panelists, but I thought James Garner should have played the spirit.
That would have been fine.
You know,
fine with me.
That he's that kind of character.
In the 60s.
Yes.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. He takes a beating. He keeps on coming.
Yeah.
He's
perfect for it.
He's rueful more than he is angry.
Mm. He really does come off as a pretty face, though, a good bit of the time. Because he is conventionally good-looking, but he's no Sherlock Holmes.
And when the strip was originally pitched, it was a detective strip. And the people he was talking to, the syndicate or whatever, said they wanted it to be a superhero strip. That's why he wears a mask.
That's why he looks...
Because they just drew the mask on and colored him in consistently.
Now you're a superhero.
There. Now he's that's all it takes.
And if you look at he felt that a costume would really constrain him in terms of the wide variety of stories he wanted to tell, I think, which is true, of course.
It would.
Yeah.
But also, if you look at the mask is such a concession, because if you could see the eyebrows and all the details and wrinkles around it's just painted on. There's no... supposedly a mask, and every now and again he'll lift it.
Yeah, it's a mask at the outside, and by the time it gets to the eyelids, it's just makeup.
Yeah, it's just a concession to the original syndicate.
And when he wants to go undercover, he doesn't take off the mask. He puts sunglasses on over it.
And nobody ever says, who's that freak in the makeup?
Yeah.
No, it's very stagey from that point of view.
Yeah.
And if you ever go to see, I don't know, Shakespeare plays where you've got a director deciding that if it's a comedy, you can make a disguise be an eye patch.
Mm-hmm.
And have everybody, you know, the character comes on with the eye patch and everyone says, you know, it's Mr. So-and-so, and then he comes on without the eye patch and everyone thinks it's somebody completely different.
Yeah, we're not familiar with that in comics.
Yeah, all those things they did in Shakespeare where colors designated certain things, you know, all you had to do to be the ghost version of the same character was to put on something green. They'd change to a green costume, or they'd put a green something over them. People accepted certain conventions meant certain things, even if it, you know, they went with it.
I mean, am I right? There's something kind of stagey about the spirit in a way that there isn't in comics in general, or something about its, you know.
I would take issue with the idea that it's not in comics in general.
Well, no, it could be there, but there's something that is very that he's quite self-conscious about.
Well, when you're trying to appease a studio into thinking you're doing a superhero book when really what you're doing is noir fiction, one would think you'd kind of end up having a few things that stuck out like that.
But he does, it's not an attempt, at least on this page, at naturalistic pacing.
No, this is
he's specifically trying to make you think of movies you've seen.
Yeah, this is much more about movies, and especially if, you know, Dolan not knowing it was in the office, you can see the shadow of the spirit in this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the sixth panel here in the this second view from the bottom. And then you have the flash of lightning outside.
Track of the moon.
And there you see the character for the first time clearly. That's obviously a, you know, that's a
movie.
Yeah, the Orson Welles thing. This is another of the very noir-y strips. Character has been let out of this is a story called The Partner. Some of you may recall the character has been let out of jail and has come back to take back what is what he feels is owed him in a classic kind of noir plot.
Like in Gunpowder, I blow up twice as just as quick, and I'm twice as dead.
Blam.
So why this one?
Well, beginning with the splash, even though I liked it. Well, I was just comparing it to Pagel, and you know, Pagel's great, but this just I like it better.
Okay. Yeah, Eisner is not merely a brilliant storyteller who. And formalist who played with the form. He draws like a dream.
I'm just wondering about Black Widow in her leather costume here, actually, whether there's an unconscious echo in John Romita. Was it Romita who played her in the black costume?
Yeah, but Romita was echoing Emma Peel. I mean, the Black Widow is probably more based on the Dragon Lady originally. Than anything from Eisner, and then she was Emma Peelized, but when Miller started doing her in Daredevil, there was a lot of Eisner to that.
Well, the face is all Joan Crawford, though.
Yeah.
Maybe we should talk about
they all were
Eisner's women. So Tim was just mentioning Pagel was the other probably most famous femme fatale of the series. But you prefer her powers to Pagel? Is it just the way she's drawn? Spiderweb theme continues across the first panels of the next few pages.
I can't really explain it. I can't. It may just be as much as the Pagel splash is so iconic. I just prefer that one a lot.
The thing I always remembered about Pagel was her putting her bare foot on top of the money in that one panel. That's just one of those odd little things. You know, let's keep the money in the family, I think is what she says, or something to that effect. It's just one of those odd little things that struck me.
I don't really like the spider motif being, the web motif being repeated.
It's actually repeated on every page, too, so you can not like it on every page. it moves around, though. It's not always in the opening panel. It moves it around. But every time there's a...
Caption.
Necessary, you know, movie through the story caption. Well, the other one that we've got here's 10 minutes. So maybe Kurt, you could talk about why you chose this one.
Because it's the best. 10 minutes is it's well. First off, I'll mention Jules Pfeiffer wrote it, and it's the spirit only shows up in the last panel, maybe the last two panels. This was the first time I saw a comic book story that was as part of a series about a hero, where the hero was irrelevant to it. He was just telling a story about humanity, about the stuff that was going on around the spirit. And it's a crime story, and it's a story of desperation and an attempt at an escape. So it's appropriate to the series. But the spirit never actually does anything. He never discovers anything. Where you would expect the murder that's committed to be discovered by the spirit or solved by the spirit, it's just the ordinary people interacting with each other.
The plot is this kid, Freddy, who turns to crime and commits his first crime and is dead within
ten minutes
of committing the crime. So the 10 minutes is you know, what can happen in 10 minutes? Well, a person's whole life can be undone in 10 minutes. You know, I'm just, maybe it's because I was seeing the Black Widow in the last one, but suddenly I'm seeing Freddie as Rorschach without his mask on.
I mean, it's the pug nose.
It's the coloring, too, I think. He's
probably.
The stripy suit and the hair. What could have happened to Rorschach if
someone had the good sense to shoot him?
Yeah, but we see this whole desperate playlet all play out, I think it's the very last line is, so I'm 10 minutes late. What's 10 minutes in a man's life?
That's right. So so he commits the murder in these two pages here. He murders the grocery store clerk. It's a totally pointless.
Yeah. Go back a page for a minute.
Well, let's see. We got, here's your first page, and then two and three. And you can see the clock ticking.
Yeah. Oh, maybe you'd just gone to the next page, and I thought you'd...
Do you want that
one? Here. That on the left-hand side page, where we have, you know, normal talking, and then it just... She leans over the counter, mm-hmm. and she sees... Eisner didn't use silent panels all that often, because he had to keep the story moving. And when he used them... He used them well. And what that does is it sets you up beautifully for the scream in the next panel as Freddie runs.
Mm-hmm. And then so Freddie meets his end.
Plus she's beautifully
gorgeous.
Drawn.
He meets his end in the subway system. And again we have some nice silent beats down at the bottom here. But yeah, the very last line. So when the spirit shows up for the first time.
Yeah, it's the last page.
Yeah, in that last page. Actually unaware that a crime is even being committed at this point.
Well, I think he knows something because he wants to talk to Freddie.
Right.
And it's the fact that he wants to talk to Freddie that makes Freddie run to do the thing that
kills him.
Yeah, and what are they talking about in the last panel?
He dropped the money.
He drops the money that he's made out of the till.
Yeah.
Freddie drops the cash, and the spirit says, "Oh, is this your money?"
So he's perfectly innocent.
He's not even trying. You know, he's actually giving the stolen money from the crime back to the criminal.
Right.
This is again a classic instance of detective failure.
Yeah.
But it's also a sort of a Hitchcock wrong man kind of a thing too.
And again, you know, the motif is, I think, more effective than the spider web is the clock, that clock ticking.
Much
oh, yeah,
better.
Much more.
Yeah. Yeah, but
well, spider webs are pretty, at least.
But yeah, this story is hugely influential on me because it's just a big spotlight saying the story doesn't have to be about the hero.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think this for me is also one of my personal favorites, and I think it's that combination of Pfeiffer and Eisner really, you know, sort of firing the whole cylinders and a sort of perfectly pitched short story. But I wonder what, I mean, the title of this panel is The Spirit in 75. I think it's interesting that the story that we're waxing most lyrical about is the one in which the spirit shows up only in the last page as a...
Well, he still has an impact, though, because he is sort of a face card. When he turns up, you know, pay attention to him.
Yeah.
There's a funny little tension between his inconsequentiality to the story. And when I sat down to make my own series, pluggity plug, I guess, I specifically engineered my book so that I would be able to put my nominal main character into the background and tell whatever kind of story I chose to. And it was partly because of things like this.
And another thing is there's a lot of comedy in this story.
Mm.
This story is a tragedy.
It's wry, I guess.
But there's a lot of comedy in the drawing. There's a lot of comedy in the dialogue. Part of that, I think, is to make it seem so normal. You know, that if it was just all high melodrama, then, you know, Freddie would be a desperate character, and he gets the end that desperate characters get. But if there's this, you know, girl there flirting with him and her boyfriend's mad at her, the girl for flirting with Freddie, he's a neighborhood kid.
Right.
The fact that the comedy happens and the characters are drawn in a cartoony way tells us, think about these as the urban equivalent of Andy Hardy.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that the humor does not diffuse the tension is what I find is beautiful.
You know,
because often when you put some funny thing in, it's like, there goes the balloon, foof, you know?
Well, the fight, from that point of view, the combat, we should probably, since I've mentioned that Spirit gets beaten up a lot, and this was actually your choice, I think. And so to the extent that he has an arch enemy, I guess the Optimus is pretty high on the list. This is a character that is portrayed almost always only by his gloves. You never see his face, which is in itself is a design challenge. So I think I've got a nicer version of this second page again in black and white. There we go.
Well, all noir detectives get beaten up, you know, every other scene.
Well,
it's just their lot in life.
This famous scene where he wakes up after having been beaten up, sees the sink, douses his head in water in order to wake himself up, is just about on his feet again, and then immediately gets the crap kicked out of him again.
By a thug who then goes back to his plate of pasta. Now, it's this cinematic stuff that had the most obvious effect on me, because it made a bridge between what you see on a screen and what you see on a page make more sense to me. It's one of those things that seems so obvious in retrospect, because, of course, this kind of, you know, timed scene where, you know, you can feel all the tension in the spirit's body, not only because of the beauty of the drawing, but because of that dripping tap, you know how hard it is for him to, you know, drag himself over there, and how desperately he is trying to get himself out of a dangerous situation, out of which he has no hope of escape. And I want to say that this scene is actually in a movie. I want to say it's the movie adaptation of Dashiell Hammett's The Glass Key. I seem to recall being very shocked. And I know this may sound like I'm slandering one of my idols, but I really don't think that I am. Watching that particular movie, or whichever movie it was, and seeing the same thing happen to the detective hero of that movie, that he's beaten up and brought to a little room, and he wakes up and he staggers over and he gets into the sink, and then somebody just, you know, casually leans over from a card game, I think it was, and just goes bonk, and down he goes again. You know, all of the pulps, both of the movies, the novels, and the comics, all happened sort of simultaneously and fed into one another, that the way a thing would be paced in a movie is so perfect for this kind of storytelling in a comic that, you know, I have no idea whether... I don't even think it's necessary to say which came first. They're both beautiful depictions of a timed and otherwise silent scene.
This is also a reason why the spirit is an adult protagonist rather than a character like Superman. Mm-hmm. Superman is indestructible in a way that is a wish of indestructibility, and the spirit is indestructible because he just won't quit. He's clearly damageable. But he just can't be ended.
I had a doctor friend explain to me that if you hit 10 people hard enough to knock them out, 2 of them are never going to get up again. 3 of them actually won't be knocked out at all, and you'll have to hit them again, and then the whole thing resets, and you might kill one of them. And then he began going on and on about concussions, and I admit I rather zoned out at the time, because more heroes, you know, they always get knocked out.
There's a lot of beating in this particular. This is a two-parter with much
physical. Many beatings.
We've got sort of the continuation into the next of the two-parters. Mm. You know what? I did include all of this strip.
You switched from the picnic. You've got the splash of the picnic there.
Yes.
And the next page is the beginning of another story.
Yeah, no, we switched to... I didn't get all of the
oops.
The
you suck.
No, this is the elevator story. He does continue all the way through looking at this now. It does not. He abandoned it after the second page, so maybe it was too much even for him.
Ah, Ebony.
Look at that. I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering again. One of the things about this
for me is that we might have
to talk about the academic energy fields that we have to acknowledge the existence of.
They're loud. Yeah, there were a bunch.
Who is enormously problematic, obviously. Every time I you will have noticed that I managed to get through, scroll through a lot of Eisen images without looking at Ebony at all. But he shows up in some of these key stories. I quite admit I feel the same way about Ebony as I do about the Piccadilly character in Vincent McKay's Little Nemo. There are these little blocks on the pages that just are truly painful to look at this point.
Yeah, although one of the ironies is Ebony is a better detective than the spirit is.
Yes, he
Ebony
is.
Ebony actually figures things out and gathers clues.
Yes. I was thinking, what could you say about Ebony that could in some ways redeem what is obviously just sort of a ghastly stereotype in terms of the way...
His character design? Nothing.
Nothing you can do about the design, but I think if you look at the first couple of years of this strip, where they wanted a superhero strip, and it looks like he's doing this crime novel. There's an Ebony solo story very early on. It's like about 2-3 months into the strip, he does an Ebony solo story, and it's the first funny story because, of course, hey, he's a humorous character. Mm-hmm. But it allowed Eisner in some ways to see the potential of... He could throw humor into this strip. It didn't have to be this serious thing after week after week. And I think also Ebony's... Everyman kind of role is very important to the strip as a whole, and maybe even Eisen's whole career, thinking about the lives of ordinary people. There was no way for him to get. I don't understand why he couldn't change the way he rendered him after a while. I mean, maybe.
I was watching Breakfast at Tiffany's over again the other day.
To change the way that he speaks at one point. There's a story where.
And then he brings in this Eskimo character who. Has exactly the same mush mouth problem, but but the thing about Ebony, I would say, is most of the ethnic sidekicks of the Golden Age
are pretty much the same.
Are horrible characters, but with characters like Milt Caniff's Connie and Eisner's Ebony, it's all frosting. It's all the way they talk, the way they look. But what they actually do turns out to be smart, tenacious, loyal, versatile, ingenious. That if you actually look at who the character is and what they do, they're pretty honorable characters. They're just wrapped up in this crap. And the ones like, Whitewash over in The Kid Commandos, it's just crap wrapped in crap.
Gus Areola took a lot of, a lot of pointed comments in what few interviews I've seen with him now, because Gus Areola did a strip comic called Gordo that was long running in three papers or whatever. But he started off as a Disney artist, and when he started doing Gordo, all the characters were broad caricatures of Mexican stereotypes, and Gus was himself of Mexican descent. And people were just kind of like, so how about that bean farmer? And he was just sort of like, they're not like that now, are they? Because over years, he sort of, evolved the characters past all of that.
Well, I know that Eisner felt, acutely embarrassed by this in later years, obviously. But it's one of the things that, again, if we're talking about the spirit at 75, it seems to me that's one of the places where the strip clearly shows its age, whereas as a designer, this stuff is fresh as anything you've ever seen. We're at the last 5 minutes, and maybe I should just, I have a final question for you, which maybe would be, to take as a whole. And that would be, if you think about Eisner and his influence upon you as creators, if there was one lesson that you could take from him, what would it be? What was the single most important thing you learned as creators from reading Eisner?
Timing. Nobody was better. Many are just as good.
For me, it's humanity. Find the humanity in the situation and whatever action, danger, comedy, anything will work better.
Mine is the visual. And the idea that you could break things up and play with them, even in a single image, but also through the story. But it's visual, it's not.
This is a great splash page too. Mm-hmm. You know that That's really bold. This is not a funny story over this funny picture.
Uh-huh.
It's all the contrast of the story is put together right there.
Yeah, this is sort of if you were to ask the internet to take a vote on its favorite Reliza story,
that would probably be it.
This would probably be the one, which is why I ended the year.
And certainly Gerhard Schnabel is just as caricatured in his way.
It's full of caricature. Everybody.
I mean, heaven knows, Powder is a caricature.
Yeah. You know.
Right. But Eisner characterizing Jews is Eisner characterizing something familiar with.
Right.
But Eisner characterizing
Scottish.
Italians. But yes.
Italians.
Yes.
Everything is pretty broad.
It's very cartoony in that way. Mm-hmm. And the really unfortunate one.
Yeah.
Is Ebony.
Well, I think we are at time, so...